This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is Nancy Pope, head curator of the History Department at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum. We talk about the early history of airmail service in the United States, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. In the news, Boeing has a new airship. Facebook cancels its Aquila project. Boeing has reportedly asked engine makers to bid for the 797. Boeing's also unveiled a hypersonic airliner concept, and a stealth tanker model is spotted. Also, TSA wants to look at your snacks. A third Heathrow runway gets closer to reality. NASA demonstrates a quieter airplane, and the Air Force reduces pilot training time. Also, finding airmail airway beacons, a conversation with Air Evac Life Team at the Circuit of the Americas, and student pilot Nikki talks about her new flight instructor. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 510 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian who blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. I'm looking forward to tonight. I think it's going to be a letter episode.
Oh, yeah. You all will realize what Dave is referring to shortly. But also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast, and he was the 2008 CFI of the year. He's also an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Max T., how are you?
Max, I am excellent, and hello, David. And I've got to get your input on this right now. I've never had to do this before. I'm in a tough dilemma here. I have two cats scratching on the door. Shall I let them in or just leave them out during the recording of our show today?
It sounds like a catastrophe brewing.
It does. It does. I was listening to another podcast, and one of the co-hosts had a cat walk into the room, walk across the keyboard with disastrous results. So, we'll leave it up to you.
I think I'll leave them outside.
All right. Well, our guest this episode is Nancy Pope. She's head curator of the History Department at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum. They're at postalmuseum.si.edu. Now, Nancy has worked with the items that are now in that collection since 1984. She curated the opening exhibits for the museum in 1993 and more than a dozen at the museum since then. Nancy's written about many elements of postal history, including the Pony Express, rural free delivery, parcel post service, the postal service during 9/11, as well as the later anthrax attacks and airmail. Now, her most recent exhibits are Systems at Work, which examines mail processing from colonial America to the present, and Postman of the Skies, a celebration of 100 years of airmail service in America. We're talking to Nancy because of the 100-year anniversary of airmail in 2018. Well, Nancy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
And yay, 100 years.
Yes, that's pretty exciting. I would not have guessed it's been that long, but apparently it is. Now, the National Postal Museum, that's in Washington, D.C., and right next to Union Station, I think?
It is. We're one of the Smithsonian museums, so we're free. And it's a wonderful museum, so everybody should stop by. We've got planes.
Yes, yes. And we're going to talk about that. Now, the building itself, is it a structure built for the museum, or was it taken over from a previous life?
It's a post office that was built in 1914. Daniel Burnham, who also did Union Station here in D.C. and was quite the architect in Chicago, was responsible for this. And it's a beautiful, beautiful Beaux-Art building. And it was used for the central D.C. post office for decades. And then in 1983, they moved the processing a few miles away to Brentwood facility. And they decided to turn this into more office space. And while they were doing that, the Smithsonian, we were kind of raising our hands saying, wait, museum would be a really good idea too. So they gave us some space and we brought our collection over and we've been open since 1993.
Fantastic. I'm definitely going to have to stop and see that on my next trip to DC, which seems to happen once or twice a year. Now, normally we have the news segment first, but this episode we're going to switch things around a little bit and we're going to have our conversation with Nancy first. So why don't we get started with that?
Because everybody knows history is far more important than the news. So did I say that out loud?
Yes.
David did.
It is.
Oh, dear.
Could I interject with just one question?
Go ahead.
Is everybody ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, Nancy, this is an exciting time to talk about the start of airmail. What was it that started mail being transported by air? What were the early events?
Well, aviation was really kind of getting a hold by 1916, 1917. And the post office really at that point was always looking at the next fastest thing. They always wanted to move the mail faster and faster and faster. So they had already conquered the boats, they had conquered the trains, they had conquered the planes. They were moving mail underground in pneumatic tubes. They'd pretty much done everything except the air. And they thought, obviously, we can, take more mail faster. We've got to give this a try. So they went to Congress, who immediately said no. And they went to Congress the next year and they said no. And then finally, 1918, Congress said, okay, we'll give you a little bit.
Well, what were the reasons that Congress was a little bit slow to accept delivering mail by air? Was it the cost or the technology of the airplanes? Do you know what?
They weren't that excited about speeding up the mail. For Congress, it was an issue of money. And they were looking at the New York, Philly, DC route as the first one. And basically, Congress is saying the train gets the mail there in 4 or 5 hours. That's good enough. Why do we need to speed that up? Why do we need to spend the money to save a couple of hours? And the post office basically came back and said, you're not just saving a couple of hours, you're saving the connection once the stuff gets to New York or Philly or DC. It's then put on a faster train if it's going to Atlanta or to Boston or to Chicago. So you're saving many, many more hours, maybe even a day, depending on what the connections are. So the post office kept selling this as it's good for business, it's good for the people, it's the next step, we've got to take it. And Congress did, as I said, finally gave way in 1918.
So that's interesting. I guess I would have assumed that the early motivation for airmail was transcontinental or great distances, but we're talking about city pairs that were not that far apart.
Well, you are, but you're also talking about a time when planes really couldn't go that far. These are planes that had about a 200, they ended up with the Jennies, the JN4 airplanes that the Army was using, and they had about a 200-250 mile that they could go. And with that, if you're going to go from New York to the West Coast, the plane's going to be stopping every 200 miles to pick up some more mail, some gas, and keep going. And it would really take as long as it takes for the train. So what they were hoping was that if they get the New York DC thing going, they could maybe get somebody to put some money into faster planes, planes that could go further, carry more mail. And then they could go further, and they had their eyes actually set on New York to Chicago, which was the second financial center of the U.S. And if you could connect the two financial centers of the U.S., then you've got business getting very excited about that. Business goes to Congress and says, yes, this is a good thing. Give them more money.
You mentioned the airplanes that were used initially. Were there any special modifications to them in order to carry mail?
There was. They used, as I said, the JN4. Actually, it started with the JN4D Jenny. And they took out the 90 horsepower OX5 engine, replaced it with 150 horsepower Hispano Suiza. And so the H became the JN4H, which was the plane they used. And it could carry about 300 pounds of mail. Problem was, when the Army was the one who was giving these planes to the post office, and actually there was an agreement where the Army would supply the pilots in the planes for the first few months. So when the Army pilots went to gather up their planes just a few days before the first day, which was May 15th, 1918, they found the planes were in crates.
Oh.
They had the engines replaced, and that had been it. So the pilots actually had to dig the planes out of the crates, grab some mechanics. This was all at Hazelhurst Field. Grab some other Army mechanics, and everybody was rushing to try and get these planes put together. It was almost like, this is now your plane. You're responsible for putting it together, testing it, and you're now going to be flying it from, you know, one city to another.
Hmm. And these are Army pilots at this point?
They were. They were led by Major Reuben Fleet. And the lieutenants were about six lieutenants that he had who were the guys assigned to do this. Out of the six, two of the guys who were assigned were political assignments. One was a guy named James Edgerton, and they wanted, the post office wanted him assigned because his dad was the purchasing agent for the post office department. The second was a guy named Lieutenant George Boyle, and the post office wanted him assigned because he was engaged to the daughter of the Interstate Commerce Commissioner, and the post office, through lots of things you don't need to know about, actually owed him a lot of favors. So out of the first pilots, you had two who were political, basically hacks. The question was, could they fly?
And were they successful at flying?
Well, actually, Edgerton was very good, and he went on to become the chief of flying later on when the post office took over everything. George Boyle was maybe not so good. He was actually assigned because he was engaged to the daughter of the Interstate Commerce Commissioner. He got to have the D.C. to Philadelphia route. Very exciting because Woodrow Wilson was down there for the opening day. There were thousands of spectators. This was down at Potomac Park, where about the FDR Memorial is today. So there's all these people down there on this Wednesday morning. Everybody's really excited. George Boyle, you know, he's got a map on his leg because that's how he's supposed to tell where he is. He gets in the plane and he's supposed to head northeast to Philadelphia. And he gets up there and he turns southeast. And only the pilots were realizing what was going on. Everybody else was like cheering, yay. The pilots are just kind of standing around looking at each other going, what?
Yeah.
And Boyle ends up crashing. Well, he goes nose down, breaks a propeller in the mud in Waldorf, Maryland, which is about 100 miles southeast.
This is the same flight, the same first flight?
This is that very first day flight. So, yes. Everybody's paying all this money to get these letters on the very first flight that's going when Wilson's there and we're all excited. And the mail ends up crashed in Waldorf, Maryland. They take the mail off the plane and they truck it back to D.C. And they got to get it up to New York, but there's no more planes, so they just put it on a train.
Oh, a disaster. So was there a lot of press, you know, about that kind of fiasco?
There was, yes. There was. Definitely. And you would think that that would mean Boyle's done, but it didn't. The second day, they sent James Edgerton up instead, and he did a good job. But the third day, Interstate Commerce Commissioner was putting his, you know, fist down saying, dang it, I want my future son-in-law to get a second chance. Put him in a plane. So they put him in a plane in D.C., but this time they're going to be smart about it. And they get a second pilot in a second plane. And that pilot's going to guide Boyle to the Chesapeake Bay. And he says, all you have to do, I'm going to get you to the Chesapeake Bay, and then I'm going to turn off. All you have to do is keep the bay on your right, fly north.
Right. You'll hit Philadelphia. Yeah.
These are directions that anybody could follow, right?
Mm.
So they get up to Chesapeake Bay, and the other pilot leaves, and Boyle's now by himself, and, you know, he keeps the bay on my right, bay on my right, and he goes all the way around Chesapeake Bay and ends up landing at Cape Charles, Virginia, which is about as far south as you can get in Virginia.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's funny. It's hysterical.
Yeah, that was his last day of flying the mail.
Well, that's good. That's good.
The other Army pilots, I got to give them kudos and credits. They were all very, very good. They did a great job. But Boyle, he was an embarrassment.
I guess so. Wow. So the Army pilots, though, only flew the mail, did you say, for 2 months?
3 months. They flew from May until August. When the Army signed on to do this, they actually signed on for a year. And they said, what we'll do is use this opportunity to train our pilots. It's a wonderful chance to get our pilots some experience because we were still at war and they wanted pilots that had more experience. The problem was the post office was very insistent that you fly regardless of the weather. And the Army didn't really want to risk its pilots in fog and bad weather. So they didn't want to send them up all the time. And so finally they said, you know, after 3 months, it's yours. We're up. We're done. And so they turned everything over in August to the post office. They moved everything out to College Park, which is now the College Park Aviation Museum.
Oh, yes. Right, right.
And they hired their own pilots. They bought their own planes. They bought six standard JR-1Bs from the Standard Company in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And they just started running the operation, again, going from D.C. to Philly to New York. Actually, they were going to Busselton, but just north of Philadelphia. And in New York, they were landing at Belmont Racetrack because they really couldn't find any other place. And August Belmont said, I'll give you the racetrack for free. So it all worked out. And they kept going there for about 3 or 4 months until Otto Praeger, who was the second assistant postmaster general in charge of all of this, decided that it's time to now get to Chicago. Okay, he still had planes that could really only go about 250 miles at the most, but he wanted to make sure they could get from New York to Chicago. So he sets everything in motion, and in September they do test flights, which are supposed to get from Chicago or New York to Chicago and back in 2 days, and that just blows apart. One guy makes it in 1 day, but he almost kills himself doing it. The other guy takes 2 days to go both ways. In December, they finally say, we're just going to go. Otto Praeger wants them up. We're just going to go. Complete disaster. Planes that were supposed to go to Bellefonte ended up in Lock Haven. Ones that were supposed to go to Cleveland ended up 20 miles south of Cleveland. Nobody was where they were supposed to be. The ones coming in from Chicago didn't even get out of the city. They landed at an airfield that was just a small little airfield created by some aviation fans, the Aerial Club of America. And it was miserable. So by the second day, just as bad, third day, just as bad. Finally, the guy in charge went to Praeger and said, I don't even know where the planes are. I've got pilots all over the place between here and Chicago. I don't know where the planes are. You got to stop this. This is stupid. And Praeger, being the guy, he was not a pilot. He knew nothing about flying. He was a bureaucrat. And Praeger looked at this and said, okay, we'll wait for a week. And in a week, we'll try again. Well, the week came around, and obviously it wasn't going to work. The first flight that went off that week just, you know, almost crashed. It was miserable. So Praeger said, okay, we'll go at the end of the month. Finally, in January, Praeger says, you know, this really could have been done if we had had enough time to prepare, but nobody understood just how tough it would be. And his guys are all standing around looking at him going, we all told you how tough it would be. We all said we need time to prepare. This is like all on you. But, you know, for the press, he put on the show of the post office gave it a big try, but, you know, life was against us and we'll try again in the summer.
So it really wasn't an issue of piloting skills or anything like that. It sounds like it was a sort of, you know, managing the overall operation.
Exactly. The pilots were very good guys, very well trained. Some of them were former Army pilots. Some of them had actually trained Army pilots. A lot of them came out of fields down in Texas. They knew what they were doing. And it just was, it was an operational mess. So they took the next, you know, 4 or 5 months to finally figure out what they were doing, how, you know, where they needed to have emergency landing fields. Oh, we need an emergency landing field. What a thought. Basic things like that, that you would think are obvious, that they didn't think of the first time around. So at that point, they, in, was it July of 1919, they finally said, let's give it another shot. And they did. And they got from New York to Cleveland, okay, and then from Cleveland to Chicago. And so it started progressing from there. And at that point, they actually start to figure out what they're doing. And they start progressing a little bit more. And by 1920, they're going across the country, although they're only going during the day because they couldn't fly at night. But they're going across the country. And they have finally gotten a plane that is worth their while. They had done the Jenny, the Standard. They had a Curtiss R4LM, a Curtiss Model R, which wasn't really that great either. But they finally found their unicorn plane. They found the de Havilland DH. And the de Havilland DH-4 was just tremendous. At first, it was a mess, but they cleaned them up. They fixed them. They changed things around, and they made it the best working mail plane out there. And even though Prager kept trying to buy other planes and use other planes, and he ended up killing his pilots with the other planes that he tried, the de Havillands were just the perfect plane, and he finally gave up and said, yeah, we're going to use the de Havillands. And they ended up using them most of the run. They operated the airmail service from 1918 to 1927. And it wasn't until the very, very end that they started replacing some of the de Havillands with some Douglas. But de Havillands were fabulous planes. They did a great job. They ended up with the nickname the workhorse of the airmail service.
Now, at this point, these are still postal pilots, correct? This is before...
These are all postal pilots. Yeah, after, as of August 1918... all the pilots were hired, were civilian or ex-military, but they were hired by the post office department. And they hired about 236 of them over their 9-year span. And these guys, oh my God, I love these guys. I am madly in love with these men. They were incredible. They were the astronauts of their age. They were fabulous and brave and entertaining. They did great interviews. I mean, just... They were very interesting fellas. They drank. They had wives and mistresses and all at the same time. And, you know, they were pilots.
Sort of a lifestyle, yeah.
There really was at that point, yeah.
Yeah. What about postage? Was the postage for airmail comparable to surface mail, I guess?
No, there was a special. When it first started in May, there was a special price of 24 cents. At that point, I think regular postage was like 3 cents or so. So 24 cents was quite a bump up. And they thought, okay, this will be great. It'll pay for the service. Everybody will want to use it because it's so much faster. What they didn't recognize was that most people didn't want to pay that much more for just an hour or a day of faster delivery. So by July, they dropped it down to 16 cents, and they dropped it down a couple other times, but it started out at 24 cents. And if you know the inverted Jenny airmail stamp, which is the most famous U.S. error, it's the Jenny plane that's on the stamp, but upside down. Only 100 of those were printed, and they were printed for the May 15th flight.
Probably very sought after these days.
We've got a couple in the collection. You should come look at them in the museum.
Yeah, cool. That sounds fantastic. So at some point, the Postal Service switched to contract pilots or contracted with other organizations to fly the mail?
Yeah, that was part of the, it was a 1925 thing called the Kelly Act. It was Clyde Kelly, a representative. And the concept was that the post office really wasn't supposed to keep doing this forever. That the idea between the post office creating this airmail, these airmail routes, and hiring these pilots and these planes and basically creating this infrastructure was that they would then pass the infrastructure on to private companies that would use it and then grow into new routes. And these companies would grow and they would use mail contracts to get the money that they needed to buy bigger and better planes. And if it wasn't for the post office creating the infrastructure and then supporting them through the 30s with the mail contracts, those companies would have gone bankrupt. William Boeing would have been making furniture back in Washington. There was nothing there for them. They could not make money off of passengers in the mid and late 1920s. They needed those mail contracts to kind of put their foot up in the door. So I always like to say, if you're looking at the long lines in an airport for everybody waiting for their plane, you should think of the post office, not because of the long lines, but because of the post office basically creating commercial aviation in America.
Yeah, very interesting. I think a lot of people don't realize that connection. Tell us a little bit about maybe some of the artifacts that you have at the museum. I know you sent us some photos of a few of them.
Yeah, we've got some wonderful things. Two of the earliest pilots, the very first and second pilots hired, were Max Miller and Eddie Gardner. And as I said, there were about 236 pilots who were hired. Of that, 32 pilots died flying the mail. Max was one of those. Eddie died the year after Max. He had left the post office, but he died in barnstorming. But we have some items from both of those. Max was flying a Junkers Larsen JL-6, which was an all-metal monoplane, one of the planes that Prager was trying to bring in to speed up the mail. The plane was just absolutely lousy. It had crashed and almost killed a pilot the day before Max went up. Max went up with one of his mechanics. And about an hour later, the plane was returning to the airfield, and they were on fire up 200 feet in the air. Max and the mechanic were tossing the mailbags out of the plane. They crashed, and both of those died. What we do have are Max is, we have his badge, which is Airmail Service Number 1. He was the first pilot hired. And we also have his logbook, which was singed from the fire, but it's a wonderful piece from Max. From Eddie, we have his...
Oh, this is good, because I was going to ask you, could we ask you to change gears here and stop talking about Max crashing?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that. We'll talk about Eddie living.
Let's talk about anybody else crashing, just not Max.
Yeah. We've got Eddie, sorry about that. It was the only Max that crashed, okay?
Oh, good.
Good, I'm glad to hear that.
So we have Eddie Gardner's flight suit, and we have his, amongst the flight suit and pieces and leggings and such, we have this great face mask. It's a leather face mask that is, if you see it, is the scariest little thing you have ever seen. And I call it the Hannibal Lecter mask. It's just...
That's what it looks like.
Yeah. But it was really warm. You know, you're up there in your open cockpit at... 15, 20, 25,000 feet up there, you want to be warm. And so it's a great mask, very, very comfortable and warming. We also have a board that was used by Benjamin Lipsner, who operated the service for the post office in the first couple of months. And it's a peg board. So it's a board with holes in it, and it's got room for pegs. And at the top, it has a listing of D.C., Busselton, New York, and the pegboards or the pegs that go in are the names of pilots. And this is how they would keep track of which pilot had which plane and where he was. And you think today, even at the smallest airport, you can't run it without a computer. This guy was running the New York, Philly, D.C. Airmail system with a pegboard.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I think we should dump the computers and go back to pegboards and manual methods. But
oh, it was great. He had little pegs for weather and everything. It was just, it's a wonderful piece.
Yeah, David?
Can I jump in?
Yep.
Anybody famous fly airmail? Asking a leading question.
The most famous fellow who flew the airmail flew it as a contract pilot. His teacher was an airmail pilot, but the most famous guy to fly the airmail was a fella named Charles Lindbergh, who flew for Robertson Aircraft from St. Louis to Chicago, and that's how he made his living before he flew across the Atlantic. And he wasn't the greatest airmail pilot in the world, which what I look at his airmail record and I think, who would have trusted this guy to go across the Atlantic? He crashed three times. One time he parachuted out twice. One time when he parachuted out, he had forgotten to turn the ignition off. And so the plane's going down nose first. The engine catches, starts back up again. And the plane actually starts circling him as he's going down with his parachute, wondering just how those circles are going to get tighter and tighter and tighter, and who's going to win the race to the ground.
Oh, my.
And it was because of his route to St. Louis that the airplane was known as the Spirit of St. Louis.
Yes.
Sorry, I had to ask the leading question.
Well, the guys who weren't as famous were really great guys too. So, you know, they were just all, as I said, they were all wonderful, wonderful guys. Some of them very, very funny. There was a guy named Dean Smith who crashed, and he sent a telegram to the post office letting them know he'd crashed. And the plane said, what was it, dead sticked, no place to land, landed on cow. Killed cow, scared me, wrecked plane.
Oh, man. Who knew that there were so many great stories coming out of the history of airmail? Nancy, one aspect of it, and we want to play a recording here from Launchpad Marzari, but one aspect of this is the issue of how do you fly back then? How do you fly mail routes across the country, across the United States? And there was a system designed, developed of airways beacons. And we're going to listen to Launchpad, who knew we were going to talk about airmail this episode. And so, well, he did a little bit of homework and a little bit of sleuthing on his own. So let's listen to Airplane Geek's reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
Hello, listeners. Let's do some aeronautical archaeology. At the dawn of aviation, airmail pilots were trying to navigate with just a whiskey compass and a road map. That's it. Aviators were struggling as they were discovering that compasses in aircraft suffer from lead, lag, and dip. These problems don't occur on shipboard or land-based compasses. Airspeed indicators based on a pedostatic system would not be invented until 1923. Functional altimeters wouldn't be invented until 1927, and both of these devices would take longer to filter their way down into aircraft that the pilots were flying. So dead reckoning navigation, the emphasis was on the word dead. So airmail pilots were mostly looking out of their open cockpit airplanes to follow the roads and the railways while trying to fly to places they had never been to before. This works well during the day, but try following railroad tracks at night. This doesn't work. Remember, during this time, airplanes don't have electrical systems and therefore don't have radios. They also didn't have a vacuum system, so none of the other gauges really worked either. So beginning in 1923, the post office worked to complete a transcontinental airway of beacons on towers placed 15 to 25 miles apart, each with enough brightness or candle power to be seen for 40 miles in clear weather. On July 1st, 1924, the Postal Authority began regularly scheduled night operations over parts of this route. In 1926, the newly established aeronautical branch of the Department of Commerce took over responsibility for building lighted airways. By June 1927, 4,121 miles of airways had lights. By 1933, it would be over 18,000 miles of airways, and 15,000 beacons were in place. What's an airway beacon? It's a big concrete arrow on the ground. Yep, that's right. A big concrete arrow about 50 feet long that says or pointed and said, fly that way. On the shaft of the arrow was a 50-foot tower with a rotating beacon on it. At the base of the arrow, or fletchings for all you archery purists, was a shed that contained a generator to power the rotating beacon. And the shed had numbers painted on it for daytime identification. At night, the beacons flashed in a certain sequence so that pilots can match their location to a printed guide that they carried with them. Besides the rotating beacon, one fixed tower light pointed at the arrow and to the next field, and one to the previous, forming a aerial roadway. Many of these airway beacons still exist, and one in Montana is still operational. So I decided to go out and do a little aviation archaeology. There are several database websites that list where the airways were and currently are. We will put these sites in the episode show notes. Cross-indexing the lat longs with Google Maps, I was able to confirm that the sites still exist. All that was left was to go find them from the air. So flying at 3,000 feet AGL over Central Texas, my co-pilot and I were able to locate the first arrow in the middle of a cow pasture, the tower and the shed having long since been removed. We then flew to the second beacon, which still had the tower intact, but the concrete arrows have never been installed on this site, as it may have been one of the beacons built later in the 30s without arrows. So we landed and began the second half of our aviation archaeology adventure, which was using land nav and driving to these two sites. The arrow was hard to find on the ground because it only sticks up about 3 inches. Yep, it's a big concrete arrow in the ground. The second site with the tower was a little easier to find, and the tower was intact and as sturdy as the day it was built. You've got to love the over-engineering of the WPA of the 30s. Throwing caution to the wind, we climbed to the top. The top of the tower gave us a better perspective as to why this would work so well. The distance to the horizon in one direction was 35 miles and 25 miles in the opposite direction. I was struck by the vista, and I was also overwhelmed by how well this simple system would work in the earliest 20th century when most homes did not have electricity. So flying at day or at night, these rotating beacons could easily be the only lights for 10 or 20 miles. Flying at an altitude of 3,000 or 4,000 feet, you could easily spot 2 or 3 of these on a clear night. This works great in clear weather. Crummy weather, low clouds, not so well. Thus the need for radio navigation. But this requires radio beacons, radio receivers in the airplane, airspeed indicators, altimeters, all of which would be invented later in this decade and perfected in the 30s. But that's not part of this adventure. So, here's a little adventure that you can do in your airplane or just in your car to go see if you can find one of these airway beacons. Safety note, make sure to get permission of the rancher or the landowner before jumping a fence and climbing on property. I have included both the aerial and the ground photos of our adventures in the show notes. This is not your airplane geek's historian, but your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Wow, thanks, Launchpad. But he really got into this, didn't he?
That's pretty cool. I like the archaeology part.
I'm a little envious. I think that must be fun hunting for stuff like this from the air. And to think I was just in Montana, if only I had known.
I would have to say, though, the arrows are only on the contract routes. So you're not going to find them on the old postal route from New York to San Francisco. Those were strictly just the beacon towers without the arrows. So there's the towers that are still up there. So if you see one without an arrow, that doesn't mean it's not an airmail tower. It could still be one.
And we're going to put links in the show notes, as Launchpad said, to not only some of the photographs he took, but links to some of these databases. And it's kind of neat to go in there and look and see what might be near you. I did that for us here in Connecticut, and there are a couple that may be around that are not too far away. So it could be kind of exciting to go and see if we can find them.
We actually have a beacon in the museum. I know I keep talking about the museum, but hey, that's what I'm here for.
Yes.
We have a beacon in the museum. We were trying to get one of the original towers when we were building the place back in the early 90s. And we finally found one, but of the four legs of the tower, three were on land owned by one person. The fourth was on land owned by another. And just try and make an arrangement like that with people. So we ended up building our own tower and putting our actual beacon light on top of it.
Wow, the challenges of building a good collection. Nancy, tell us a little bit about some of the events commemorating the 100th anniversary.
Well, we had, the post office has issued two stamps, or has issued one, and will issue a second one celebrating the centennial. The first one was issued on May 15th at our museum. It was a lot of fun, and it was the blue centennial stamp. The red one will be issued on August 11th at College Park Aviation Museum, and there's going to be a big party there, so people should go. There's going to be, I think, hopefully a Jenny that they'll be flying there, if not, then the de Havilland. But there's going to be definitely some plane flying going on at College Park. And both College Park and my museum will be doing lectures and programs celebrating the centennial all through the rest of the year and into May of next year. So it's a lot of fun. And the exhibit will be up through May of next year as well.
And these stamps, the blue commemorative stamp and the red that's coming out shortly, these are forever stamps that you can go to your local post office and buy?
They are. So if you buy them now, then you've saved goodness knows how many cents the next time they increase the price of a stamp, and you don't have to buy any more. So go buy lots of airmail stamps.
So, and these are good for just the standard first-class postage?
Yep, they're just a regular first-class stamp.
And when there are commemorative stamps like this, and these are great stamps. I mean, they have the biplane on the stamp prominently. They're really nicely designed stamps. They have also kind of I don't want to say an older feel, but they sort of evoke that era, I think, in terms of the design and all. Are these printed in just a limited quantity and that's it? Or would you be able to buy these 10 years from now?
Well, no, I mean, there are obviously limited quantities, but they do take stamps out of rotation after a bit because they issue, 30 to 40 stamps a year. And so they want to make sure that people are buying the new ones that they issue. So after the first year or so, if you want to buy one, you usually have to go to a stamp dealer or a philatelic store.
But otherwise, then, if I want to stock up on these stamps for the rest of my life, then I should do it now, huh?
Yeah, you can buy them online or you can buy them at your post office.
Cool. Anything else about the anniversary or about sort of airmail in general or the museum that you wanted to mention to our audience, Nancy?
Well, the Postman exhibit is a temporary one, and I said it ends on May, but we have a permanent exhibit celebrating the airmail service, and it is a wonderful piece, and it's the core of our atrium portion of the museum, and there's three planes. There's a 1911 plane that was used by a fella in California to carry the mail. His name was Fred Wiseman, and it took him 2 days to go from Santa Rosa to Petaluma. For those who don't know, that's about 19 miles. He had to land and something was wrong with the plane and had to take, as I said, 2 days to get there. And we have the beautiful de Havilland airplane, which is, as I said, the workhorse of that airmail service. And I just love that plane. We also have the beacon and the tower. We have upstairs our Amelia Earhart flight suit. And there weren't any women who were hired to fly the mail specifically, but women flew the mail on special occasions. And Amelia actually flew what they called philatelic mail, which means that she would, on her flights, take some mail from, what, let's say, I don't know what her Mexico flight was, but when she got to Mexico, she'd take the covers, the envelopes out, and then she'd sign them, and then she'd sell them. And she and Putnam used that money to then help buy the next plane and then finance the next flight. So she was really great with the philatelic mail. And some of her collection was donated to us, as well as one of her flight suits. And so we have that in our collection for people to view. And I have to mention this because it is my all-time favorite question I have ever had from a member of the public. I get calls, emails all the time, people with questions. And this one fellow whose name I will never share called one day and wanted to talk about Amelia Earhart. So we did for a while. And I said, you know, of course, that we have her flight suit in our collection. And he just got so excited. He said, from her last flight?
That's great.
And I thought, do I just wait for him to catch up here? For
oh, boy, am I adding that to the list?
I was wondering why, you know, why you would never say his name, but now I understand why.
He will always be anonymous.
Oh, that's man. Great. That's a great story, yeah. All right, well, I guess the next thing coming up is, as you mentioned, the Red Letter Day at the College Park Aviation Museum. That's in College Park, Maryland. That's August 11th, and we'll put some information and link to that museum in the show notes so you can follow up there. But it sounds like it's going to be, Nancy, an exciting day.
It will be, and as I mentioned, we're going to be doing lectures and things at our museum too. So if you go to our website and look at the special events and upcoming events, check it out and see what we'll be doing, because you know, it's a year-long celebration, and we've got lots of ways to celebrate.
Fantastic. Tell our audience again where they can learn more about the museum and these topics that we've been talking about.
Well, our website is www.postalmuseum.si.edu, and that's SI for Smithsonian Institution. And we are located in Washington, D.C., right next to Union Station, which, if you know D.C., is right on the Red Line. So we're very easy to get to, and just come on in. Enjoy it.
Wonderful. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Sure.
The news. Our first story comes from, well, Ohio.com. This is Goodyear's new Wingfoot 3 takes to the skies. Now, the Wingfoot 3 is the newest of Goodyear's airships, a semi-rigid airship built by, let's see if I can get the German properly pronounced. Let's see, Luftschiffbau Zeppelin. Now, the blimp still has to undergo some flight tests before it's formally handed over to Goodyear. Max T, I guess this is the third of these new generation or new technology blimps for Goodyear.
That's kind of funny. We're talking about some of the oldest of technologies, but they're certainly getting updated in time. I flew right next to November 2 Alpha, which is one of the Goodyear blimps here on the West Coast, all of maybe 2 weeks ago. Whenever it's up here in the San Francisco Bay Area, it's based at the Livermore Airport. And we were off there doing some pattern work, so I shot some video as we went by it. But I'm surprised you didn't open this up by saying, and Max, have you ever flown the Goodyear blimp before?
Oh, and the answer to that would have been?
Yes, I have.
Wow!
Great fun. Yeah, this goes back to about 1992, and this is the oddest thing. I had put together a list probably 6 months before, maybe a little bit less than that, of, you know, like 5-6 major things I still wanted to accomplish in my life. And I put that one down, Fly the Goodyear Blimp, as a, you know, this will never happen. But it was the first one to come off the list, and it was very odd. I was listening to the radio one day. There was an ad for Goodyear tires, and they said, and if you purchase, you know, you can possibly fly the Goodyear, or not fly it, but, you know, get a ride in it. And so I'd been planning to buy tires, you know, maybe 6 months, a year later. And I thought, oh, the heck with that. We're buying them now. And went out there, brought my pilot's license, showed it to the pilot. And he goes, well, of course. So we were up there in the airship, which, as I recall, sat 6 people total, including the pilot, which, you know, just one wicker basket chair for the pilot. And at some point over Oakland, he climbed out of the chair. You have to climb over the back of it. And I climbed over the back of the chair to sit in it for about 20 minutes. I was the sole pilot of the Goodyear blimp over Oakland. So great fun.
Wow, that's very cool. Well, according to what I'm seeing here, these new models are longer than the old blimps, a little narrower, they're faster, and they seat more passengers. The new ones are 246 feet long, which is 52 feet longer than the older generation, which is quite a big difference. They have a top speed of 70 miles an hour. The older ones flew at about 50. And the passenger gondola seats 7. No, it did seat 7. Seats 12 now. Well, we have a video, or Goodyear has a video of the Wingfoot 3 flying for the first time. We'll put that in the show notes. So of the three wing feet, I guess you'd say, N1A is based in Pompano Beach, Florida, the Wingfoot 2, N2A based in Carson, California, and Wingfoot 3, the new one, newest, is based, or will be based, in Suffield, Ohio. So if you're anywhere near any of those locations, maybe you'll have an opportunity as well.
And one thing that's different about Wingfoot is it's a semi-rigid model, and I think that's how they achieve the higher speed, because essentially, you know, in the bad old days, you had a gas bag and you had a, the gondola, there we go, I'm losing my words, attached to the bottom, and all the engines were on the gondola, and so you're essentially pushing against a bag, but by making it rigid, you can then transfer that energy more efficiently from the gondola to the semi-rigid superstructure, and that way you can get a lot more speed out of it.
Then it no longer becomes a blimp.
Exactly. Technically, it's an airship.
Well, it's right. It's a rigid airship, and it's commonly known as a Zeppelin, which is the same company that made the Hindenburg is now making these.
Yes, which is, that's kind of amazing. That's kind of amazing. But I think Goodyear is going to continue to refer to them as blimps. I think, you know, sometimes the popular names aren't always accurate. David, of course, you and I know that that's often true for drones, that a lot of the aircraft that are called drones are not really technically drones. But speaking of drones, and also one aircraft that won't be taking to the skies, well, that's the Facebook Aquila, the solar-powered atmospheric satellite, if you will. They've canceled that project. Facebook has canceled that project. The idea was that it would bring internet connectivity to areas that that have none. David, you and I talked about this in the last episode of the UAV Digest.
We did. We won't go into a lot of detail in this, but it was interesting how much fanfare when we first started talking about Facebook getting involved with Aquila, and how little fanfare the announcement was that they were getting out of the business. And they've basically decided that this is a little bit out of their league. And there are other companies that are doing a better job at creating persistent satellites. The other interesting aspect of this is I think they need money for other things like privacy protection for the whole main organization. So it's one of those things where they reached out and started to broaden out probably too quick, and maybe Facebook's coming to the realization that they probably should be doing what Facebook does.
And I think they probably discovered that doing high-altitude aircraft is just a little bit more difficult than they thought. I think there is a spirit here within Silicon Valley that high-tech companies feel that they can just hire the smartest and the brightest and somehow they can make anything happen. And actually, you can make just about anything happen, but it comes at a cost. I think they probably found that it was going to cost more and it was more difficult than they thought. And I think that some of those things may be happening with Google. Google has a lot of different aerospace-type projects going on as well, and I'm suspecting that a few of those may be getting pruned. But that's also just kind of classic portfolio strategy, right? You start with a whole number of different bets, and some of them pay off and some don't, and obviously this one is not paying off for Facebook.
And another new airplane that may be launched, Max-T, is the Boeing. Well, it's called different things, but maybe it's called the 797. You see, in CNBC.com, Boeing reportedly tells engine makers to make bids for new 797 plane.
And that's pretty exciting. I guess that's somehow one of the ways that we find out about new aircraft is when the vendors are told to, you know, start putting bids in it. I don't know much about what the 797 might look like. Do you?
Well, Boeing wants to build a new mid-sized airliner, something that can be flying by 2025, which isn't all that far into the future, at least when it comes to, you know, getting a new design up and running. They call this the middle-of-the-market jet. Some people call it the 797. It's also been called a new middle-market airplane, or NMA, basically something that replaces the 757. Now, Boeing is looking for 25% less fuel burn per pound of thrust than the engines used on the 757 planes. These are looked to be around 45,000 pounds of thrust, which is a little bit more than the thrust of a 757 engine. And this is, you know, this is reports. The usual suspects are named as having received requests for bid. CFM International, which of course is the General Electric and Safran joint venture, but also Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce. So it's the big, you know, it's the big three engine makers. And I mean, this is, well, the aircraft isn't launched yet. Some people are speculating that maybe Boeing will announce the launch of the aircraft at Farnborough this year, but we don't know. But as you can imagine, the lead time on these things is pretty significant. And, you know, if Boeing is thinking about a plane in that time frame, well, the engine manufacturers have to be already working on designs that meet the requirements of Boeing. So I suspect those conversations have been going on between Boeing and the engine OEMs for quite some time. I guess how Boeing is going to treat the engines. Are they going to go sole source like they do on the 737? Are they going to dual source or tri-source the engines? And of course, that has a big impact on the business plans of the engine makers. You've got to look at what's the forecasted size of the market for that plane, and then how many engine OEMs are supplying engines. If there's, you know, three engines offered, then, you know, divide by three and assume that's the best you might do in terms of market share. How does the economics work out for that number of engines? So it'll be interesting to see. It reminds me of the 787 when that was in its earlier stages, and all three of these engine OEMs were developing designs and competing. Pratt & Whitney ended up dropping out because the market size didn't justify the investment that it would take. And so Pratt says, the business case doesn't work. We're out of here. So I'm curious to see what happens in this case.
And I was also thinking about the 787 because I think that was the first airliner that was a major departure from Boeing's prior strategy, where essentially they were responsible for just about every aspect of an airliner. With the 787, they chose to outsource large portions of it. And by doing that, they essentially spread the risk over many different companies. But the trade-off was that their returns are going to be lower for that than if they had taken on the whole project themselves. And of course, I think the logistics and the communications required probably went up geometrically, which I think was probably something that they weren't totally prepared for. So what do you think? 797 going to be kind of like that model or move back a little bit more toward the traditional model? And if it moves back toward the traditional model, can they get it in service by 2025?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That kind of service date suggests something that's not a clean sheet of paper, brand new aircraft, or something that's using technology or materials that are vastly different from what already exists. So it might be a growth of something that they already have. But it's really hard to say. The other thing to keep in mind is that Airbus is reading these press reports just like everybody else is. And sometimes the information that comes out is meant to paint a different picture than what you really intend for competitive reasons. And so we don't know if that's happening or not. Time will tell. The big thing is Boeing going to announce the program launching, and will that take place at Farnborough? We'll have to wait and see.
And supposedly Delta's going to be the launch customer.
Yes, David, that's right. Delta has gone on record as saying they would like to be the launch customer. They want an airplane like this. They want a large single-aisle airplane or something that serves the same kind of market. Whether it's single or double, I'm not sure that's established.
I don't think any. I think the 757 was in a class by itself, and I don't think there was any replacement, especially for the hot and high climates. The 757 was dramatically overpowered, and if anybody's ever seen one rocket out of an airport, it's a very impressive aircraft. And a friend of the show, John Ostrower, posted some drawings of one of the possible prototypes, and it kind of looks like a 757 crossed with a 787. So it's got that nose, but it clearly has got that look of a 75. You know, so we'll see. I'm looking forward to it. I don't think an Airbus has got anything to compete with something in the class of the 75. So we'll see. And if Delta's on board, that's a good start for Boeing.
Yeah, Airbus likes to say, hey, we've got the A321. And, you know, that serves that purpose. But we'll find out. It's always fun to watch these things. But another fun thing, another possibly new aircraft, from Boeing unveils hypersonic 4,000-mile-an-hour airliner capable of New York to London in 2 hours. So, Nancy, you talk about getting the mail there fast. This is real fast. This is like a Mach 5, kind of an aircraft three times faster than the Concorde.
Well, in 1918, they made it from D.C. to New York in 3.5 hours, so...
This is small, this would be the design, smaller than a 737, something that would have both commercial and military applications. David, I think that anything that flew Mach 5 would probably have some interest with the military.
Yeah, absolutely. And by Boeing saying there would be interest with the military, they're also saying, hi, guys, you want to fork over some money for our civilian project?
Yes, yeah.
But I don't know. Right now, Boeing is not in good graces with the Pentagon. Over the tankers that are sitting there waiting to be delivered. So it's an interesting scheme that, you know, we want this hypersonic aircraft, but let's also sell it to the military. And I don't know if the military wants a hypersonic aircraft that civilians are tooling around in also. So interesting monetary strategy, I think, with that.
The Boeing commercial airplanes chief scientist for hypersonics, Kevin Bocut, has said that the choice of Mach 5 also affects the propulsion option. He says, quote, "We know we don't need a scramjet because we can do it with a kind of turbo ramjet." Now, he's talking about something that's like the Pratt & Whitney J-58 engine that powers the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird. It's a turbofan that transitions to a ramjet at Mach 5. But why Mach 5? Why not faster? He points out that going faster requires something beyond that, something like a combined cycle engine, something that combines a conventional turbine engine mode along with a ramjet or a scramjet. That's a whole bigger kind of a thing. So that's something that Boeing unveiled at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics Aviation 2018 conference that was just held in Atlanta. But something else came from that conference as well. And the Drive has an article, "The new stealth tanker model is touted by Air Force Research Lab at Aviation Conference." And this is a little model that Aviation Week's Guy Norris noticed. It's a model of an advanced aerial refueling aircraft. And this was in the Air Force Research Lab's area. David, they point out that the Air Force may be looking for a more survivable aerial tanker. I mean, we're still trying to get the latest tanker into production and into action, but this is the next step beyond that?
This is rolling in stealth capabilities into a tanker. We do have special ops refueling squadrons that are designed to work with high-value stealth aircraft like the F-35 or the F-22, or any sort of special ops missions like the MC-130s. And they're used to flying, believe it or not, 135s with like infrared goggles, etc. In this case, this would be a stealth aircraft, low visibility. A tanker orbiting is a sitting duck. If you have an aircraft that's low visibility that can provide fuel to other low visibility aircraft like the new B-21, and the B-2, as well as our fifth-generation fighters, the 35 and the 22, more power to them. Also, you'll be able to deliver cargo in a low-visibility aspect. And what's unique about this is a couple of years ago, there were some strange-shaped aircraft flying around that were being reported that looked awfully similar to this tanker. So you never know, the Air Force Systems Command and the Air Force Logistics Command might actually have some already.
That's interesting. You always think there must be things out there that the general public isn't aware of.
It's a tanker I approve of.
All right. A little TSA item. Max Trescott, what's going on with the TSA?
Oh, it's always something when it comes to the TSA, isn't it? I think somewhere in their stated mission it must be to make the travel experience more difficult. And, well, you know, that's probably not totally fair. Certainly my experience with the TSA has been reasonably good over the years. And by the way, I got probably 2 or 3 months ago, and I'm loving it. It's nice to be able to, you know, get through the line a little bit faster these days. But we've gone from, checking, water bottles to, taking off your shoes to now they want us to show our snacks as we get on board. This is being tested at some airport. So that may be the wave of the future. You know, before you hop onto the airplane, show us your food.
I have to ask, how is my snack threatening anybody? There's got to be a reason here.
Yes, yes. That's a really, that is the question, I think, Nancy. And it turns out that the TSA is saying that some food items tend to present themselves as explosives or as components of explosives. Now, I don't know which kind of it's your candy bars or I don't know what. And so that when you have some of this stuff in your checked baggage, they see it when it's scanned. And oftentimes that has to go to secondary screening to find out, okay, what is this? Oh, it's just a candy bar. Fine, go through. But that takes a lot of time. So the TSA has a recommendation. This is not a policy, apparently. It's a recommendation to screening supervisors that they might speed up the overall process if they have people pull out all their food and put that in the bin. So that way, when it goes through the X-ray machine, if something looks funny, the guy can look down and says, okay, that's just a candy bar. The problem is that people are going nuts over this because of, you know, the same reaction that you guys have had, that, you know, this is crazy. What's the point of checking my food? So it sounds to me like, you know, it's a communication issue that in certain airports, the local TSA team has decided that they're going to follow this recommendation, but there hasn't been enough, apparently, communication with the flying public as to why this thing actually might be a good idea.
Are you sure it's not like the movie theaters? They're mad that we're not buying our snacks
at the right place.
Oh, it could be.
Now, if the airlines were in charge of security, that might be the case, but I don't think the TSA is selling food on the airplane, so probably not. But I love what this passenger in Orlando International Airport said, trying to guess what the motivation was behind it. They mused, some terrorist is making bombs out of Frito-Lay.
Yeah. That was kind of nice. I mean, that was the whole thing with the liquids and the 3 ounces there and all of that, because there was a threat that was related to that. But
Pop Rocks.
Yes, Pop Rocks. Oh, my gosh. Don't get me started. Next item. Heathrow gets go-ahead to become world's biggest airport. Now, they've been talking about a third runway at Heathrow for years, and it's a contentious issue. And I've learned that stating a position on the expansion at Heathrow is like giving an opinion on Brexit. You're going to make half the Brits mad at you. But now a parliamentary vote has passed that would allow construction to begin of a third runway.
Well, I think we could probably make 100% of them mad if we work really hard at it. And just to let you know how authoritative a source this is, this comes from the denverchannel.com. So, I mean, when I want information about the UK, I go to the denverchannel.com, which is where I happen to find this particular story. But I think what's really amazing about this is if and when it gets built, and apparently it sounds like they've, you know, gotten over one of the hurdles, they say that by 2030, it could jump from nearly 80 million passengers a year to 110 million, which would make it the biggest in the world in terms of air traffic. That's pretty phenomenal.
But you're still going to have to divert if the flag's flying over Her Majesty's castle.
You know, some things you just can't fix, right? One thing you can fix sometimes is the noise airplanes make, right? People complain all the time about noisy airplanes overhead. And, Max, we see in AvWeb interesting results of some testing that NASA has been doing.
Yes, so NASA, according to AvWeb.com, has shown significant aircraft noise reduction. Now, we've talked a lot in the past about how NASA is trying to reduce the sonic boom thump that occurs on the ground, but this is something totally different. This has been done with a GA aircraft. In this case, I believe it was a Gulfstream. And they are changing things on the aircraft to try and reduce the noise made by the airframe, not by the engine. Who would have thought? I mean, I think most of us think of engines as being the source of the most amount of noise. But I got to tell you, there are nights when I'm sitting here in my studio office and I have the window open, and I swear I can tell when an A320 goes by the whistle, you know, of that particular airframe as it goes through the air. So clearly, there are things about airframes that create noise. And they think they could reduce perhaps as much as 70% of airframe noise during landing, which would be a big deal since noise complaints are one of the biggest problems that local airports face. So in this particular case, they made some changes to the landing gear. They stretched a net across an opening to alter the airflow, align it more with the wing. They also installed an adaptive wing flap. So it's fascinating to me that they're looking at basic airframe technologies to reduce noise.
Yeah, they're doing this on a Gulfstream 3, I guess.
Yes, and testing it down to Edwards Air Force Base. They've got a setup there with 185 microphones in a big array, and then they fly the aircraft at 350 feet above it to test different configurations.
We have one more story. This is like the the longest news segment, or at least the news segment with the most stories in it. This is from where? Express News, Air Force cuts pilot training by 5 weeks. This must be to address, what, a shortage of Air Force pilots?
I'm guessing that's what it is. Certainly there's a shortage of pilots everywhere. The Air Force has been having the same problem that civilian airliners are having, which is finding enough pilots to staff the cockpits. In this case, they're talking about going down from, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 54 weeks of training to about 49 weeks of training. So cutting about 10% of the program off. And of course, you kind of got to wonder, well, gosh, are these pilots going to be just as good, even though they're getting 10% less time in the training program? And I think different people have different views on that, and we probably won't know until people go through this program.
All right, let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks really quickly. David, anything aviation-wise going on in your world these days?
Yeah, I'm in USA Today. 2 years ago, I was asked to be an expert on picking out a list of 20 air shows for USA Today's top 10 or 10 best. So we'll have links in the show notes, but there are 10 air shows, and you get to pick which one. And in 2 weeks, we'll announce the winner. So go to the links in the show notes. It's 10best.com, best air show. And again, I'd like to thank USA Today for the privilege of doing it. And most likely, it'll be Oshkosh that'll win as usual.
I remember this from last year. Yeah, it's kind of exciting. So yeah, we'll put that in the link to that in the show notes, 10 best. And Max, anything with you?
Yes, indeed. I want to give a shout out to a name that might be familiar to some listeners on the show. This person is the newest master pilot, and he recently received his award in Chicago. And just to tell you a little bit about the master, it's called the Wright Brothers Master Pilot Award. And it's an award that pilots can apply for. And it's the way the FAA recognizes pilots who have exhibited, I'm reading from their website, professionalism, skill, and aviation expertise for at least 50 years. And, of course, one caveat is they have to be a U.S. citizen, and they cannot have previously had their airman certificate revoked. That will disqualify them for the award.
Wait a minute now. 50 years in Chicago?
Yep. Uh-huh.
Can I guess who this is?
Yeah, can you think of somebody who was around when the Wright brothers were around?
Yeah, this isn't Rob, is it?
It's Rob Mark.
Are you kidding?
Rob received his award late last week, and there was about 45 to 50 people in attendance. The local FAA manager from the Chicago FISDO was there, and they made the presentation. And, of course, he received a very nice plaque and an honor that he richly deserves.
That's amazing. This is no small thing.
No, this is a big deal.
Wow. Way to go, Rob. Congratulations.
Exactly.
That is very cool. Next up, we have a recording from our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. He had a fascinating conversation at the Circuit of the Americas. Now, you might know the Circuit of the Americas. It's outside of Austin, Texas. And this is a world-class auto racing venue that hosts Formula One races, MotoGP, the World Endurance Championship. This is big time. And Launchpad had a conversation with some folks from Air Evac Life Team. This is the group that maintains the services that provide medical evacuation in case that there's an accident on the track, something that requires a significant medical attention. So let's listen to Launchpad Marzari.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And we're at a different event. We're here at the Circuit of Americas during the World Endurance Championships. But we're in with the Medevac team as the race is going on. And I'm here with
John Linardos
and
John Jones, Program Director for Air Evac Life Team.
And these guys are, if you will, the helicopter or Medevac standby team that's right here on the track. In fact, we're right behind pit lanes We stepped into the office to get away from the din of the racing that's going on right now. All right, let's start off with John. What is the aircraft you have sitting on standby right now?
We have a medically configured Bell 407. It's basically full of gas, and it can take off and do a 2.5 hour mission, which would get us up to maybe 400 miles. But we're set up right now to go to the local hospital in Austin, and if we get a bad burn, we'll go to San Antonio, the burn center there at SAMC.
Why a 407 and not something maybe a little more economical?
Well, 407 is not a bad economical aircraft. It's a little quicker, and my base in Carrizo Springs, we use a 407 because our flights are very long. And one of the reasons we got the 407 out here is they wanted us to be able to take our crew of two, a medic and a nurse, and take an extra physician with the patient. So we'll have 2, 3, 4, 5 people on the aircraft, including the pilot. We get an extra seat out of the 407 as compared to like the 206.
And John, tell us about AirVac Life Team.
AirVac Life Team is a company that is based out of O'Fallon, Missouri. We have approximately 300 aircraft nationwide, about 26 bases, I believe, here in Texas alone. AirVac provides rural access, so we tend to station out in rural communities so that we can provide quicker access to that patient in timely need of care.
Right now, you're contracted by COTA, Circuit of the Americas, not the World Endurance Championship.
Correct. We just started this contract recently. We came to an agreement with COTA to provide the air medical resource here, and we'll be providing it for this race as well as Formula One next month. Then we'll revisit the contracts for next year, which we're hoping to be here for the MotoGP, the Formula One, and the World Endurance Challenge.
If someone wanted to apply, what are you looking for in pilot hours?
Our pilots can always go to lifeteam.net. To find all our positions that are open throughout the nation. We typically require about 2,000 hours of experience. At least 1,500 hours of those are in helicopter and at least 1,000 hours of pilot and command time.
And obviously a commercial ticket has to go with that because you're flying commercially. Pilot John, we're sitting here underneath Class Charlie Airspace because Bergstrom Austin Airport is just a rock throw away. Talk to me about what happens when you need to launch.
Well, from where we're at, we'll just directly call the tower. They'll give us a discreet squawk, and then we'll follow their directions as we depart. But we can't just blast out of here because we are within, I think we're a half mile into the airspace, so we can't just come in and sneak around.
Are they giving you any expedited handling when you're actually under mission?
Yes, they've been extremely helpful. They gave us a discreet squawk that we already have right now. So when for example, if we got a flight right now, I'd call them up and say, hey, this is Life Team 7-1. I'm at the Circuit of America. I've got a patient. I need to go to downtown Austin for the Seton Hospital. And they'd probably divert everybody and they'll let us go right on through.
John, talk to me what happens is we've got an accident. Talk us through what you do as a policy of your company to get us spun up here.
So the way it works right now is COTA provides physicians throughout the track as well as medical personnel. Travis County EMS is out there and all the safety personnel for COTA track who are wonderful. If there is an accident, they will respond initially and they will transport to this infield hospital that's ran here by Del Seton. Within this hospital right now, we have 4 physicians, two surgeons, and 2 emergency room physicians. They will evaluate the patient immediately and determine if air medical is needed. At that point, they'll do their best to stabilize, and we'll transport from here into Del Seton downtown, or as he said before, to SAMC, which is the burn center, Army Medical Center there in San Antonio.
I'll play devil's advocate. Suddenly we've got a bad accident and we're starting to maybe transport a patient here. You leave, what am I doing for backup?
So the best part here is that AirEvac has assets throughout this whole area. Surrounding this area, we have assets in Cuero, Texas, Seguin, Texas, Marble Falls. Those are our three closest, and LaGrange, Texas. So LaGrange or Seguin can actually be here in under 20 minutes. So the minute that we see there is a potential to fly, we get a bad accident, we spool up those birds in one of those locations, and we'll get them headed this way. If we have to bring them in and land them here and determine there's no need for them, then we send them home. No harm, no foul, as I guess they say. Otherwise, they get here and these guys have to take a flight and that helicopter leaves. There's no interruption in coverage for the race and the WEC. We still have an aircraft here in case there happens to be another accident. Or this aircraft is actually also available if someone fell in the stands and was severely injured. If there was a heart attack out there, and time is muscle, and the faster we can get them to the proper care, then the better chance of them recovering from that. So this aircraft can actually be utilized for more than just the drivers. We'll just have to call in that secondary aircraft.
How many hours a year do you get to fly, John?
I fly about 120 hours a year, maybe a little bit more because with overtime. But if I was just working my typical seven-on, seven-off schedule, I'd probably fly about 120 hours.
And sim time? Do you have to do any sim times?
Yes, we do simulators every quarter. So every 4 months, we have a simulator. We have some in some of the local Texas area. There's actually a 407 simulator in Shreveport, Louisiana, that we contract out, and our instructor pilots check us out in those. And then we also have one in O'Fallon, an actual Level D machine in O'Fallon for our annual training that we go back and do.
And I understand you own these sims, right? They're not the one here. You actually own your own simulator.
Correct. The two simulators in O'Fallon, Missouri, are owned by Air Evac Life Team. And we utilize those to keep our pilots up to date and trained. The nice part about our fleet, most of our fleet are Bell 206s. We do have quite a few 407s and some A-Stars throughout the fleet. Most of our 407s we keep on the southern border of Texas and some other areas where they are needed for longer flights. They're also nice because they're all equipped with glass cockpit. They have traffic avoidance, so that's going to help us when these pilots lift off out of here.
Well, this has been pretty cool, Gee, what a get over. You get to come to the race and watch World Endurance Championships and Porsche take another victory, as your job. What a get over. John, if people want to know more about your services, where would they go again?
Absolutely. They could go to www.lifeteam.net.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency changes approved. Good day.
Next up, we have the 13th installment from student pilot Nikki. Here she is.
Hello, airplane geeks. Nikki here again. Today, I'd like to talk to you about my Discovery flight. And no, not the Discovery flight I had when I first started training. This Discovery flight is actually the second one I've had. In mid-December or beginning in December, my former flight instructor quit. So I got a new flight instructor in the beginning of the year. My new flight instructor and I got together and decided to do Discovery flight just to get to know each other, talk to each other, and just to see how we kind of mesh. So he and I went back and forth, texting back and forth, trying to get an idea of what I have done, where my flight training was and everything. And I was totally fine with that. He seemed really nice. We'd throw out a joke or two, which was always fun. We kind of worked well, at least over texting. When we got together, we did a 30-minute ground. Again, reviewed everything in my logbook to look where I was. And he asked me, well, what do you want to do? We can pretty much do whatever you want. And I said, well, let's go do something fun. Let's fly out to NASA and do if you remember one of my formal recordings, the shuttle run, and fly over the shuttle Inspiration. Or technically, we don't fly over it. You fly next to it since it's sitting at the runway. And he said, okay. So we went out, pre-flighted the airplane, took off, and headed east. Pretty much from our airport, head east, then head south down the coast, can't miss NASA. Went ahead and did the flight, and we went ahead and went over the shuttle, and I even went ahead and took a photo of the shuttle Inspiration sitting out there next to the tower, and came back. But I thought I'd talk about some of the questions I asked my new flight instructor. The first one I asked was, you know, how long have you been flying? You know, how many hours do you have? And his reply is, I have about 350 hours. I just became a flight instructor. And I was like, okay, well, kind of like my other flight instructor, not a big deal. And I asked, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to become a, you know, permanent flight instructor? Do you want to go in the airlines? And he told me, you know, I'm going to Riddle and, you know, my goal is to become an airline pilot. But with 350 hours, I said, well, you know, you'll probably be a flight instructor for at least a year. So that's fine for me. You're not going to run away on me again. And we went back and forth. He asked me a couple of questions and I asked him a couple of questions really to see if we meshed. And then, you know, the jokes started. We started throwing jokes about this or jokes about that, talking about what planes we've flown. I talked to him about, you know, when I was 16, my parents got together and bought me my first flight lesson. And I've always enjoyed that. I told him, you know, I was a Riddle student. I used to go out with my friends all the time. And we went back and forth about Riddle, which was really cool. And we started meshing. And on the way back, I think kind of the nail in the coffin happened with my new flight instructor. After we landed, you know, shut the airplane down, tied it down, we were walking back to the building. There was an airplane sitting out on the ramp that I've never seen before, and I don't even remember what it was. It was some, I called it the ugly duckling, but it was some turboprop. I don't even know what it is. It looked like a jump plane that parachuters were used, but it was probably the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And we both looked at it and said, what is that? And then he did the coolest thing. He just turned around and said, well, let's go look at it. I was like, okay, well, my other flight instructor never did that. So we went out there, walked around the plane, looked at it, and he pulled out his phone and started pulling up the tail number to see what it is. And we probably spent 10 or 15 minutes just on the ramp talking about this airplane for no reason whatsoever, just to geek out of it over an airplane we've never seen before. And we came up with the name Ugly Duckling just because, I mean, it had... It just looked like an ugly duckling. That's all I can say about it. But, I mean, the plane could probably had a takeoff distance of 5 feet with how big the engine was on it and looked like it weighed less than a 172. But through all of this, my flight instructor and I, we clicked really well. And after that day, he asked me, he says, do you want to keep going or would you like to talk to other flight instructors? And I said, no. Let's go ahead and I'll fly with you. We seem to be going really well. Believe it or not, I didn't realize how big of a mistake, teaching-wise, that was. In the future, I'll talk about some of the things we did, but let's just say he kicked my butt in learning. This kid knew more about flying, weather, and everything aviation than I could possibly think of. In fact, every day, still today, he still teaches me tricks. As stressful as it was to deal with that, all that new learning, it helped me so much becoming a as I went through my flight training. And I'll talk about that more in future recordings. So this is Nikki saying goodnight. Fly safe.
Thanks, Nikki. Yeah, Max, the relationship you have with your flight instructor, I think, is pretty important.
It's actually primary. I think it's probably the single most important thing in flight training is to make sure that you mesh well with the instructor and that you really trust that person and that you really believe that they are knowledgeable and that they're going to keep you safe. Because I think once you have those things kind of nailed down, it just makes it a more relaxing environment and it makes it a lot easier to learn.
Now, we had some feedback from one of our listeners, Denver Brockler, who was listening to episode 505, where we had part 11 of Nikki's series, and had a couple of issues. He said that there were a couple of errors. He talked about asking for traffic advisories. He said that pilots stating traffic in the area, please advise, is not a recognized self-announced position and or intention phrase and should not be used under any condition. Max T, is that kind of a jive with your perspective on this?
Yes. If you look at AC 90-66B, which came out in March, gives recommended practices for non-towered airports, and it specifically says these things. Now, these things are things that are commonly said by probably a third to half of all the pilots, so it's going to take a long time, I think, for them to comply with the new guidance. I agree that just saying, you know, any traffic in the area, please advise, is an absolute waste of time on the radio. pilots should be listening on the frequency and making their first call at least 10 minutes, at least 10 miles out before they arrive at a non-towered airport. And that's plenty of time for everybody to state their position. And then in terms of active runway, I admitted in a podcast that I just did recently on Aviation News Talk, where I talked specifically about the new procedures for non-towered airports, that's something that I have used a lot in the past, and I've now stopped doing it. And the FAA's contention is that a non-towered airport, there is no active runway. It's whichever one people choose to use, and sometimes people choose to use different ones. So, yes, the language being used at non-towered airports is often inconsistent. I will say some of the feedback I got after I posted that episode was, you know, people would say, yes, it, my airport, you know, I see this all the time. And somebody else would, you know, say they see the opposite of that airport. So I think that there are local practices and probably, you know, these phrases are used a lot more at some airports than others.
All right. Thanks for that. One quick shout out. We see Hiller Aviation Museum is having an open cockpit day on July 11th. So that's coming up pretty quick here. This is in San Carlos, California. They'll be holding an open cockpit day. This museum is a great museum, but it's relatively unknown to the general public. Has collections more than 50 aircraft, lots of interesting artifacts and displays. So you can look at Hiller.org, and I think they'll have that there, but we'll have a full link to the announcement about the event in the show notes. And of course, you can always find interesting aviation events in our aviation event calendar. That's at avgeekfests.com. Look for stuff there to do. And if you have or know about some interesting activities going on in your area that AvGeeks would be interested in, please feel free to add them to the calendar.
And I should mention that that is just up the road from me. I'm very familiar with the museum since our Aero Club in Northern California holds its annual banquet there every year. Last year we honored John and Martha King, and it's really kind of fun to hold the dinner in the museum because people can wander around the museum before we sit down for dinner. Also, one of the really great things about this museum is it backs up against the taxiway and the runway at San Carlos. So whenever I'm up there and I taxi off the runway onto the taxiway, go right by the back of the museum where they have essentially a miniature grandstand that kids can climb up on, which gets them above the fence so that they're, you know, perhaps 10 feet up looking out over the fence directly at the runway. And I must mention for any pilots that are not aware of this, there is an unwritten rule in aviation, and that is any time a pilot sees a kid, you are required to wave at the kid. And so I'm always, unfortunately, being in the right seat, I'm not usually the one operating the aircraft, so I'll often open the door so the kids can clearly see that I'm waving and start waving like a fanatic. And it just thrills the heck out of them. So I encourage everybody else, anytime you see the kid at the airport, wave at them.
Great advice. All right, just to finish up, we've been getting some feedback from listeners who are going to Oshkosh this year, 2018, and quite a lot of you are going. We heard from Jason. He and his son are planning to attend Thursday the 26th through the end of the show on the 29th. He notes he thinks somebody from the Airline Pilot Guy crew is holding a meetup at 10 a.m. on the 26th at the Brown Arch. So we have that. Also, Moshe said, just want to let you know, plan on being at Oshkosh for the first time. He's going to be there from Tuesday through Thursday, and he's bringing two of his sons. He'd be interested in meeting up with some Airplane Geeks listeners. Also, Ranjit writes in that he's been an avid listener for the past 3 years. He's a CFI based in Long Beach, and he's going to be at Oshkosh, be there all week, camping at Camp Scholler. This is his fourth year, will be his fourth year attending. He's interested in meeting up. Also, David Abbey is going to be at Oshkosh. He's going to be there with Isaac, Jet City Star.
That'll be a great pair, I can tell you.
And he's going to be there, he says, spending some time with Hillel, another listener, and Jennifer Adams, also Mike Carrolls. He's going to have a great time there. And then finally, we heard from Launchpad Marzari because, well, We always hear from Launchpad Marzari, which is a good thing. And he says, we have an Airplane Geeks meetup at AirVenture Oshkosh. He said, Podapalooza is a celebration for podcasters and podcast listeners. It's held right on Celebration Way, the main street of the show, on the evening of the Night Air Show. He says the event is catered, free food and drink. There are door prizes, ICOM handheld radios, headsets, free subscriptions, lots more. Meet the voices in your head, he says. And Pipistrel is the host again this year. They have been for, I guess, the last couple of years. He notes Rob Mark always shows up if he's there. And he says your reporter at large is the MC for the event. He says he will have smuggled some German chocolate in for the listeners to the podcast. So I think that probably is the best opportunity. The Podapaloozas are always a blast. And as Launchpad said, it's basically all of the aviation podcasts or those who are at Oshkosh get together for sort of a mega episode, and it's a great way for listeners across all of those podcasts to get together and meet and have a great time. So I think that's a great idea.
And I did book my airline tickets over the weekend, so I'm now committed. I'll be there arriving on Sunday, departing on Saturday at Oshkosh.
Very cool. All right, well, we're going to wrap this one up. Kind of a long episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sticking with us through the episode. Of course, our guest was Nancy Pope, head curator at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum. Nancy, again, thanks so much for coming on the show, and tell everybody once again where they can learn more about the Postal Museum online.
Well, it's been lots of fun, and you can find us at www.postalmuseum.si.edu.
And also on Twitter, right, at Postal Museum?
We are on Twitter. We are on Facebook, Instagram. You know, you name it, we're there. We're a very social group.
Fantastic. All right. And look forward to meeting you next time in D.C. Definitely going to check out the museum.
All righty. Looking forward to it myself.
Be sure to find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, they're at airplanegeeks.com/510. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And of course, you can find me on Friday, where we talk about modern delivery on the UAVdigest.com.
Drone deliveries. Max Trescott, where do folks find you?
All of the usual places. They can find me out at the Palo Alto Airport in California anytime they'd like to go flying. Of course, online, they can find me at aviationnewstalk.com. Just click on contact at the top, or you can also find the show in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Cool. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me in LinkedIn, as David says, at the UAVdigest.com. And if you can't remember that, just go to Drone Podcast and it gets you there as well. Also on PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby and friends from the Runway Girl Network. Our outro music is by Bruno Massone. And so please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.